Well, thank you very much. And I'm just delighted to be here with the National Council on Arab and U.S. Relations. I'm sure it's totally accidental that we're here just a few days before the election when all these issues are up for grabs. But I do want to say to and can give my congratulations to John Duke Anthony and to Admiral Berenson. You've got a wonderful program today. You've got, and tomorrow, you've got all of the key issues. You've got the key authorities on these issues. And I think that the participants here and the audience that's watching will be able to really get their teeth into the issues. I've been given 15 minutes to introduce this and then hopefully have a few minutes of dialogue with you all who are here. Let me just say that we are, of course, in an election season. And the charges are flying back and forth, but there are some principal issues that underlie all the charges and all the concerns that Americans have. And many of these ideas do revolve around the strategic relationship between the United States and the Arab world. So let me go into this very quickly to set the stage. The last 8 years in the United States, to my mind, have been unusually difficult and traumatic. We've had four crises. Each of the crises was preceded by warning. In each case, the warnings weren't acted on properly. In each case, the government took action. And in each case, the difficulty, the crisis, the challenge is still unresolved. It started in the early summer of 2001 when the warnings were received about the increasing terrorist threat and Osama bin Laden's determination to strike the United States. No one knows if 9/11 could have been prevented, but what the evidence does show very clearly is that the proper actions weren't taken to pull the government together to do everything possible to prevent that strike. After that, we went to war in Afghanistan, a strike which I think was fully justified and necessary in terms of going after the people that struck the United States. But secondly, there was a strong movement afoot to take the outrage of the terrorist strike and turn it into public support for an invasion of Iraq, an invasion that, in my view, wasn't compelled by the imminence of the threat. It was purely an elective war. There were warnings that this would be difficult, but they were brushed aside. And so now here we are, 5.5 years into this conflict. We still got 140,000, 50,000 Americans on the ground. We've spent hundreds of billions of dollars on it. And there are still enormous political and economic challenges to be resolved. I don't think the American people understood the incompetence of the execution of this effort until they saw it up close in the third crisis, which was Katrina. And only when it was portrayed across the country and people from New Orleans began to come in communities and tell their story, and 3 and 4 and 6 months later people were asking how long these people are going to stay in our hotels, did people begin to understand the difficulties connecting bold expressions of ideas with effective execution of policy. And now, of course, we're in the midst of this enormous financial crisis. Four crises, 8 years, and it's not just a matter of execution. It's really a matter of some old ideas that have outserved their purpose. And I think that regardless of which side you're on in this election, and I'm a Democrat, and I'm very proud of that. I'm not apologizing for that. But I think regardless of which side you're on, it's time for new ideas, and I think both candidates reflect that. New ideas, because the old ideas haven't worked. Old ideas in terms of security, the idea that it was the military that could somehow save us. I spent 34 years in the United States Armed Forces. I love the men and women in uniform, but ask any general or colonel, and they'll tell you, please do everything you can before you put us in to the conflict. It just makes common sense. The United States, to be safe in the world, has to make more friends than enemies. We have to build our alliances. We have to use the exchange of information. We have to use our diplomatic power, international law, our economic strength, the power of ideas, living up to our own values, and only as a last resort, call on the men and women in uniform to go in and risk their lives. Because when you use military force, it's permanent. It's easy to get in, it's hard to get out, and usually what looks clean and simple turns out to be dirty and difficult and complicated. And that's how it's turned out. And so I think there's time and there's a willingness, there's a necessity to have some new ideas in the security field. I think in the economics field, it's the same. We talked about an ownership society, and we've certainly encouraged the creation of capital, but it turns out that we built a society on debt, not on ownership. And we've hit the wall on debt. Home mortgage debt, credit card debt, automobile loan debt, subprime debt, CDSs, CDOs, and as the American public gets into it, we're slowly beginning to understand that as important as the banking system is, if you don't deal with the root of the problem, the American consumer, the American homeowner, and the American family, you can't fix this. The United States is still more than 20% of the world's GDP. This economy is built more than 70% on consumer and consumer confidence and consumption. And so without restoring that confidence and that purchasing power to the American family, you cannot bring this economy back. It's not just a matter of providing liquidity to the banking system. That liquidity has to go all the way down. And that's a very difficult challenge. It's going to require some new ideas. And finally, another cluster of new ideas. This building's named for a great president, Ronald Reagan. And I recall being an Army officer and listening to him talk, and I voted for Ronald Reagan. I was proud to do so because he helped restore America's military strength. But one of the things he used to say was, don't be looking for government to solve everything, because government's not the solution. Government's part of the problem. And yet, maybe the idea had a strong validity in the early 1980s. But today, government is part of the solution. And we are looking for government to have a vision to take us forward on security, on the economy, on how we relate to the world, on matters like energy, and certainly in terms of the American body politic. Which brings me to a fourth set of new ideas. In the 1980s, with the rise of the modern Republican movement, it became clear that through new communications and new technologies and exquisite understanding of voters, you could target your political message and you could build enormous strength. But the consequences of it seemed to be that you built the strength out of dividing a country. And you separated one group from another. Some people were more patriotic, others were non-patriotic. Some had more faith, others had no faith. Some were good people, some were not so good people. And this sense of division has itself become an issue. It's time for some new ideas on security, the economy, the role of government, and how leaders pull the American people together. And as I say, regardless of who wins this election, I think you're going to see some of those new ideas coming out. What would my expectations be? First of all, in the area of security, I think you're going to see major diplomatic outreach. It'll be outreach that's both U.S.-led and multinational, and it'll work in clusters. I think there'll be a Southwest, South Asian cluster of diplomatic initiatives. Pakistan can't be allowed to fail as a state. And this requires not only dealing with Pakistan, but dealing with the Kashmir issue, dealing with Pakistan and India's relationship, and, of course, dealing with what's happening in Afghanistan. The place to start is with strong diplomacy. I think you're going to see a second cluster around Iraq. We've just nibbled at the edges of this so far with the first tentative conversations with those with whom we disagree. Will we talk to Syria? Will we have a dialogue with Iran? Will we bring all of those who have a stake in the outcome in Iraq together and actually provide a forum for the exchange of issues, the exchange of information, and moving the region forward peacefully? I think you're going to see a major effort in that regard. I think you're going to see a fundamental effort with regard to Israel, the Palestinian, and Lebanon issues. And these are three major clusters of diplomatic effort that I think are inevitable. I think you're going to see a separate channel with Iran. I think the option of using force with respect to Iran's nuclear desires is not off the table, and Iran should not believe that it is. But I think that the use of force would have to be considered a last resort. And before it's too late, I think Iran should be called directly to account for itself on its actions and its aims and its programs. I think in economic development, you're going to see a major effort from the West to work with the Gulf to work in Pakistan and pull Pakistan together. I think you're going to see an effort to try to give economic hope to Afghanistan. I think it's possible, if you look at Afghanistan, that Afghanistan wouldn't have to be the center of opium production. It could be a center for wheat production in the region. All you have to do is provide know-how, capital goods, water, and a market. And it's certainly easier to ship wheat than it is to ship pomegranates. So I think with a little bit of leadership, people in Afghanistan could be given hope that their country has a real purpose in world development. Afghanistan also has natural resources like gas, which hasn't been fully developed, and it's a wonderful transit area. So I think you're going to see some major efforts at economic development there. I think energy independence is going to move to the fore. Energy independence for the United States, but greater reliance, greater development of green, of renewable and sustainable resources around the world. It's only necessary. It's not directed at any particular group or country or effort. It's simply essential because at 85 million barrels a day, no matter what the price of oil is today, with a growing world population and economic development all over the world, it's clear that the age of petrochemicals has to be supplemented and eventually supplanted by new ways of providing energy to human activities. I think these forces and activities and approaches come together sharply on Afghanistan and Iraq. On Afghanistan, we're going to need a real strategy for success. Two more, three more, five more, eight more brigades of U.S. soldiers is not a success strategy for Afghanistan. The military are the first ones to tell you that. Neither are the provincial reconstruction teams. What's needed instead is a broader strategy that combines diplomatic outreach in the region with economic hope for the people of Afghanistan, with the kind of security measures that are essential, and the political measures inside Afghanistan to bring those who doubt this together at the table and give them a stake in a positive outcome. And with respect to Iraq, I think you're also going to see a strategy that uses the withdrawal of American forces to incentivize a reconciliation of the longstanding political issues inside Iraq. Iraq, unlike Afghanistan, sitting on a sea of economic hope in terms of its undeveloped oil potentials, but it can't be realized without the kind of diplomatic and political efforts in the area that, frankly, we haven't seen pushed as intensely as they need to be thus far. So I think, ladies and gentlemen, as you look at the culmination of this election season, that what you can expect to see with regard to U.S. and Arab relations, regardless of which party wins, is new ideas. New ideas in terms of national security for the United States, new ideas in terms of our economic approach in the world, new ideas with respect to the U.S. leadership. And they will definitely impact policies in this part of the world. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to take your questions.
General, I have a number of questions here. And what I'd like to do to enable you to gauge the amount of time you want to spend on each one, I'll read four, and then we'll go back and start from the beginning, if that's okay. Can efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear capabilities, nuclear weapons in the region succeed, or do we need to learn to live with a region where nuclear proliferation is a fact? Number two, how do our military involvements in Iraq and Afghanistan end? Is victory a relevant term? are cross-border incursions by U.S. forces into Syrian territory or Pakistani territory necessary, or are they counterproductive? Do such actions poison the well of our ongoing relationships between the United States and these governments? Can the American military sustain its current levels of long-term deployment in terms of financial and human costs? And what needs to change to assure a 21st century military that is well-trained and equipped and able to maintain sustained deployments? And back to number one, that's the cross-border incursions by U.S. forces into Syria and Pakistan.
Well, that's certainly an ambitious list of questions. Did you write all those yourself?
No, I did not. They came from the audience.
Well, let me just, if I can, sketch out quickly some responses on these. First, with respect to nuclear proliferation, I don't think we have to give up on the idea yet that we can halt the proliferation of nuclear weapons into this region. I think it's too early to give up, but I think it's clear that we cannot continue to outsource the dialogue exclusively to our European allies. We are going, as the United States, we're going to have to participate directly in this. And in a dialogue without preconditions, but a dialogue with preparation. And we need to talk urgently and directly to Iran. Iran is, in many respects, the key, and Iran is still, I believe, it's not too late to have that dialogue. So I wouldn't give up on the idea of halting nuclear proliferation. How do we end the military? I'm going to get this glass of water for a second. How do we end the military engagement? You end the military engagement because at some point people decide they don't want to fight. You don't end it by killing people. You end it by persuading the people who are fighting that there's a better alternative than fighting. This requires a combination of diplomacy, economic assistance, communications, outreach, and security. So what we're looking to see is a strong set of plans for both Iraq and Afghanistan that move us in that direction. I don't think it's possible to say that under no circumstances will a force that's deployed in fighting not conduct cross-border raids. But I do think that the tactical advantage of a raid like that has to be weighed against the strategic disadvantage. With respect to Pakistan, it is, after all, a nation of 170 million people. You can't put a brigade of the 82nd into Karachi and control the country, as much as people might want to. We did encourage President Musharraf to leave, and we did encourage a democracy. And we should give the Pakistani people adequate time and the support they need to legitimate that democracy and show that it can handle its own internal tasks. It's a real challenge in a time of global economic crisis and faced with the kind of domestic insurgency that the Pakistani authorities are confronting. So I think that the strategic realities of Pakistan argue that we're not seeking an invasion of North Waziristan. That's not a solution to the problem of Pakistan at this point. But if would I say that we would never conduct or should never conduct a strike? Listen, that's really up to the people on the ground and the dynamics of that situation at that time. What the people of Pakistan should appreciate is that Americans understand, respect their democracy, want them to succeed, and are pulling for their economic and political strength and rejuvenation. With respect to the United States military, I just say that no one would have believed that the United States Army and Marine Corps, volunteer forces, could have sustained this mission for this long without resorting to the draft or other measures. They have done a remarkable job. And my hat's off to the leadership, to the men and women, and especially to the families. who have put up with repeated deployments. Their patriotism, their love of country, their commitment to the principles of the United States are truly remarkable. So I think we have to honor the men and women in uniform, even as we seek some new ideas on how to keep America safe.
Sir, I have another question here I think would be interesting for you. You were pivotal in bringing an end to the brutalities inflicted on the Muslim Bosnians and Kosovars. What lessons were learned that might be applied to the Arab-Israeli conflict in light of John McCain and Barack Obama emphasizing the need to protect Israel, but saying very little about the need to protect Palestinians?
Well, I think that if you go back and look at what we did in the Balkans, it was about, first, it was about starting with an attitude of respect for all parties. Secondly, that some very talented people led by Ambassador Richard Holbrooke were told, get this done or don't come back alive, basically. And we stayed in the area and we worked it and worked it and worked it. And that required the most intensive diplomacy. And third, it required exquisite attention to detail. Ultimately, it was the leaders that decided on the exact boundaries to be negotiated and the exact wording of agreements. So I take three lessons out of it. Lesson number one is respect all parties. You may have to talk with people that, at one point we talked with indicted war criminals, and we didn't want to, but we did, and it turned out to be important. Number two, that you must have a committed, talented team that is told you have no alternative but to work this until you produce a solution. And number three, you've got to get into the details. No broad brush, down into the details, and stay with it and work it.
Sir, that's it.
Thank you all very much for the opportunity to be with you. I wish you the best for this important conference. Thank you.